On March 7th, 2016, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time retired from the game of football, Peyton Manning. He will undoubtedly be selected as a first ballot Hall of Famer when he's first eligible next year. About 4 months after Manning's retirement, this week's guest released his first book, and there are definitely some ties to Peyton Manning's career in this book, because it all started with a guy named Archie.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is March 7th, 2016, and we are at Peyton Manning's press conference. We might be sitting in the back because you know we didn't get a good ticket, but we're here to witness him officially announce his retirement. Now, Peyton Manning, for me, the host, one of my favorite players of all time. My cat's named after the dude, as I'm sure he was a favorite player for many others out there. And yes, next year, when he's eligible for the Pro Football Hall of Fame, he will be undoubtedly a first ballot Hall of Famer. But arguably, his legacy started way back in 1971. You know, like 1971, is that when he was born? No. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is 1971. The draft. The NFL draft in 1971 is when his father, Archie Manning, was drafted number 2 by the New Orleans Saints. The Mannings, sure, that's a well-known name out there, right? And Archie Manning was the one who got it all kicked off. And pro football really did take off in the 1970s, because this is not too long after the merger, and it was kind of transforming into being baseball as America's favorite sport into what it is now. Football as being America's favorite sport, and the NFL was rising. And this week's guest is Joe Zagorski, and his book, well, his first book, that is, contends that the 1970s may have been the most important decade of all time for the NFL. He also wrote a book about the 1972 Green Bay Packers, which normally when we think of 1972, we just automatically think, well, maybe the Steelers, but no, we also think about, oh yeah, sure, there's that undefeated team called the Miami Dolphins. Then he also has a book about Hall of Famer Willie Lanier. And we'll get more into the details of these books as we go along in the interview. But first, I wanted to make sure that you knew I included links to all these books for you to purchase if you'd like, and more information about Joe in the show notes, which you can get to through your podcast player or by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com. Again, that's thefootballhistorydude.com. Also, while you're at it, I ask that you please subscribe for free to the show by mashing that little subscribe button in your podcast player of choice. That way you get the hottest, freshest out the press episodes, well, each and every week. But without further ado, let's get into the interview with Mr. Joe Zagorski. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Football History Dude podcast.
Hi, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I had to bring you on the show because you have multiple author of many books. And the thing that I wanted to ask you to start off the show is describe to me why you feel it is important to share the history of the NFL.
Well, the NFL, unfortunately, forgets its history too often, especially beyond the years of 1980 or so. And I just think that it's so rich, the stories that are, they're so rich. It's an important thing to remember because, you know, tomorrow's Hall of Famers will be from today. So I just think that what the fellows did back in the 1970s, which is the era that I like to write about the most, what they did really set today's athletes to let today's football players up for such future success. It's what they did years ago to pave the way for, you know, the game that we see today.
Right, yeah, and speaking of that, I mean, like, of course, your first book that you wrote was about the 1970s. Was there any particular player, moment in history, games, what have you, that kind of shaped your love for the game?
Well, of course, you know, you have to remember the famous events of that era. Of course, you know, the Immaculate Reception, famous plays, Miami's undefeated season of 72, Hail Mary pass, Roger Staubach in 75, and of course the dynasties. There are several. Of course, it started with Miami, you know, of course, Dallas, Pittsburgh, Oakland. Even the Los Angeles Rams had a pretty great dynasty, winning several different division titles. I think it was like 6 years in a row, something like that. So there are just so many great stories about the 70s. And of course, that was the beginning of Monday Night Football, which was a staple among television viewership for many, many decades. It all started in the 70s. Of course, there were several pro football player strikes in the 70s as well, which also helped today's athletes because of the collective bargaining agreements that they helped to foster. So there was just so many different things that happened in the 70s that I just didn't want those events to be forgotten. And so that's why I wrote about them in the 1970s in the NFL.
Right, yeah, and speaking of that, let's go with your first book. It was titled The NFL in the 1970s, Pro Football's Most Important Decade. And you just mentioned a few. I'm sure there's many more. Go ahead and try to explain to me why you think that's the most important decade for the NFL.
Funny story. I never titled it that. The publisher, they sent me the proofs, and they said, oh, here's the title. What do you think of it? It's like, oh, I don't have a say in this? No. So I said it was an exciting decade and all that, but they decided that it was the most important, which started with a whole bunch of arguments from a lot of other football historians. No, the 60s were the most important, you know, and it went back and forth. But now that I've had some years to, you know, reevaluate everything, to me, it was the most important decade, just based on all those different things that occurred, those events that I had said. Plus, there were a lot of other things. The household names that we still remember today, O.J. Simpson, Joe Namath, Roger Staubach, Bob Greasy, Fran Tarkenton, Terry Bradshaw, Lynn Swann. I could go on forever. All those guys played in the 70s. And today they're still being, you know, remembered. I don't know if you can remember players from the 60s that well, or, you know, players from the 80s or 90s even. When you think about it, there's a few, but, you know, we're talking over four decades now, and people still are talking about Joe Namath. He still has commercials on.
Right. And
so young players, young people might not remember Joe Namath's playing days, but they'll see him on these commercials and who's that guy? And why is he guaranteeing something?
You know? Right.
You know, so it's the 70s for me. That's when I was a kid. And that's when I first started watching pro football. And I just, you know, just developed a love for the game at that time and wanted to write about it so that other people, you know, years from now would remember it.
Yeah. And did you have well, I guess I should rephrase this. What was your favorite team growing up?
Actually, I had several. This is another bone of contention that I hear it all the time because I get, oh, you're a homer or you're a front runner, things like that. I grew up in just northwest of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. So I was an Eagles fan, and then I was a Steelers fan. I also enjoyed the Cowboys and the Vikings. I never really had a love for the Dolphins, strangely, you know, but, and they were winning at the time. You know, and then of course, now I pretty much like all the teams when their front offices and their public relations departments help me out when I'm writing. Oh, I became a fan of the Saints last week, you know, something like that. So it's just, I like the game so much and I watch as much as I can. And I kind of miss out on the fact that I didn't live and die with one specific team. But, you know, I've known a lot of friends of mine that have had premature heart attacks because they were fans of the Vikings and things like that. So, I guess you could say I started out liking the Eagles because they were the closest to me, but it grew from there.
Right. Yeah. And I, as a Lions fan, I'm showing you my sweater here and my hat that, so in my life, I've never really known anything except for at least I had Barry Sanders. That was all I can really hold my head on there. Speaking of influential players or coaches or whatever have you, could you give me what you would believe is maybe a Mount Rushmore of the 1970s as far as the top four most influential characters of the game?
You know, there's so many. Characters, wow. Do you mean...
You know, that's really an open-ended question. I understand it's almost impossible to really answer, but maybe go with that you helped the four individuals that helped transform the game from during that decade really into America's sport as opposed to before it was baseball.
Okay, I'll have to go. I hate to do it, but I have to go with a lot of quarterbacks here. Roger Staubach of the Cowboys, Terry Bradshaw of the Steelers. Those were the two main ones. Let's stop with quarterbacks there for a second and then go with, coaches, if it's okay. Don Shula and, Tom Landry. I think that, you know, those four, unless they want to build a second or third Mount Rushmore, which I don't think they can do too easily. but there's just, you know, what they did. I mean, Landry's innovations in the game, both offensively and defensively. A lot of times you can, you know, find out that a coach is really great in one of those two, but not both. Well, he was great at both. The flex defense, the 4-3 defense, and then rejuvenating the shotgun offense. That's Tom Landry. And, of course, Don Shula, all he did was win games and lots of
them. Right.
No coaches won more, not even Belichick. And then, of course, Staubach, he was the quintessential, I think Steve Sable called him the Hemingway-esque type of a player because of such storybook, Naval Academy, served this country, two Super Bowl championships, America's team, quote unquote. And then, of course, Terry Bradshaw, four Super Bowls in the 70s and won all of them. You can name a lot of other players too, that have done great things. There are so many great running backs, and the game changed, of course, in the 70s. Well, you had rule changes that really changed the way the game was played. One big change, it was in 72 when the hash marks came closer in to 18 feet, 6 inches apart from each other. And that opened up a lot of, you know, running backs into getting 1,000-yard seasons. And then in 78, they decided to let the receivers run free past 5 yards of the line of scrimmage. And the game became a passing game. Vince Lombardi said that the game was first and foremost a running game, and that will never change. But Vince never lived long enough to see the 78 season and beyond. Now, if you can't throw the ball, you're not going to win.
Right, yeah, you're stuck in the water. I mean, you got to have a best, of course, is balanced attack. But if you don't have a quarterback, you mentioned, of course, quarterbacks and coaches, and that's the most important position in professional sports. So It's something that obviously is going to be coming to the forefront of everyone's mind when you ask, what's the most important X or Y? And me growing up, even before I researched the history of the game, I knew all four of those names, hands down, backwards and forwards, just because that's something that how much of a legendary status they were. And to your point, the 1970s did bring forth a lot of players that even myself as just a general regular fan when I was growing up, I knew the names, and it's just that the lore of the Immaculate Reception or the Terry Bradshaws or going on and on and on of all these other players that were there. And what was it like? Because I wasn't around that 72 season for the Dolphins is like just an outside fan. What was that like?
You just kept waiting for them to lose, and they never did. And it was like, well, okay, they just beat Buffalo by 1 point. So how good could they really have been? And that's the biggest mark on them against them is the fact that they did have a soft schedule in 72. They did play some playoff teams, but not a lot. And a lot of the teams that they did beat, they didn't really destroy them. They beat New England pretty handily. That's true. But, you know, like I said, they struggled against Buffalo. The Jets gave them a couple of good games. In fact, you know, Buffalo and the Jets probably should have beaten them in the Orange Bowl. So, you know, but they proved their mettle in the playoffs. They could have lost to the Browns. If Mike Phipps had not thrown five interceptions, they would have lost to the Browns in the playoffs. But they came from behind and beat the Steelers in Pittsburgh in the AFC Championship game. And they held the Redskins to 7 points in Super Bowl VII. And they really, their defense didn't give up that. That was Garo Yepremian's passing faux pas. So watching the 72 Dolphins was kind of unique because you just kept waiting for them to lose. And you kept thinking, well, this will be the week. Well, somebody better beat them soon. They're already 10-0, and it's 11-0, 12-0, and then who are they playing this? Baltimore. Oh, they're going 14-0. You know, and they did. You know, so it was like I just watched history being made. It was kind of unique in a way. Looking back on it now, it's like, wow, it's never been equal.
Right. Yeah. The only thing I can in my lifetime, as far as the NFL goes, is the Patriots and then losing to the Giants. I mean, there was a lot more media coverage, I'll say, yeah. But what was the comparison? Because they were blowing teams out. Was it the same feeling at all? Or
for me, it was like not. I don't want to get this wrong. I didn't really hate the Patriots, but I really wanted to see them lose because I think they were running the score up against other teams, whereas the Dolphins weren't. You know, they were playing a lot of times down to the level of their competition. The Patriots, they were destroying teams in that year. I forget the year that was. Was that 2000?
I think that was 2007, I think.
Was it? And they were just destroying teams. And I'm thinking, holy cow. You know, so by the time that they were playing the Giants in that Super Bowl, I've never been a Giants fan before, but I was that day.
Yeah, I was a big Giants fan that day, too, and I guess more so because of the underdog story and that kind of thing. And I like the whole defense. It's easy to not want to root for the Patriots when you're not a Patriots fan. I'll just put it that way.
Well, most of the country was cheering for the Giants that day.
Right, yeah.
But no, I don't know if there's a real comparison because you know, with the more of the media, the attention that the Patriots got, you know, I kind of think that didn't really do them any favors because of so many people just couldn't stand them by that time. Whereas I don't remember the Dolphins really being, God, I hope somebody beats them in this title game or something. No, I don't remember seeing or hearing that.
Now, on the flip side, I guess, with that same kind of point, with now there's a lot more media coverage, do you feel that there was a more of a lore factor back in the 70s for the men of the gridiron as opposed to nowadays?
Yeah, I do. And the reason is because it's the game hasn't been oversaturated, you know, like it is today. Back at that time, after the Pro Bowl was played, you had 5 months at least until football training camp started again, and you didn't see a lick of anything football on television. You didn't see it on the newsstands, really, except for maybe you got a monthly football digest if you were lucky. Other than that, forget it. Now you've got the 24-hour-a-day NFL Network. You've got 24 hours a day ESPN coverage, sports coverage. It's oversaturated today, and the game amounts, 17-game season now next year, I think. I think people have gotten tired of it to the point where, you know, I mean, college football is now more of a business. You know, in the 70s, you got college football games televised on one station, ABC, and you got maybe, if you were lucky, three games a Saturday. That was it. That was it. And on special Saturdays closer to the bowl season, you might get four games. But, you know, and then, of course, there was no college playoff at that time. So you had your bowl game was your final game of the year, no matter who you were.
Right.
And if you didn't, you know, win your conference, you know, you're not going to a bowl. And they didn't have this rule where if you won six games, you were bowl eligible. That was a joke, you know. But today's game, you can get bored with it in a way. Now, I know with the coronavirus going along, people are just starving for any live sports, and we're not having any right now. So you're watching reruns of sports. But I still think that pro football is oversaturated today. I kind of wish that they would have kept it just at no more than 16 games, no more than three preseason games, you know. But I don't make those decisions.
Right, yeah. The majority of my life, I've always been able to just, like you said, NFL content at the fingertips. So we've been inundated with the ability to be able to grab what I want when I want as far as it. But then there is also that I don't have that feeling like you did back when you were growing up of waiting for Christmas morning for the game to come right up. It's like now there's Monday night, there's Sundays, there's Thursdays, there's everything. So I love it because I love the game. But at the same time, like you said, I don't have that. Oh, I got to wait for so long for this one big moment. I mean, I have NFL. What's that called? With you can the NFL Game Pass when I lived down in another state where I could watch my Lions wherever I was. That wasn't the case back then. That was a whole different ball game. So going to the game meant more. Nowadays, people tell me, well, I don't want to go to the game because of all these camera angles, but they don't feel that passion that it is. And the fans just all together for one, like you do when you're at the game. So one of the things I like to do on the show, of course, is take my DeLorean back in time. And I like to go explore, and I wish I could do that. One of these days, I'm going to invent where I can peer into the world of, you know, that whole, I want to be like a fly on the wall type of thing. That's down the road. That's for Elon Musk to get to. But speaking of Elon Musk and innovative, Coach Lombardi was one of the innovators, of course, out there. After that, they kind of went downhill. And then you ended up writing a book about one of the Packers' comebacks. And that was what, your second book or third book?
Second. It was the second book. The year the Packers came back, Green Bay's 1972 resurgence. It was the only season in the 1970s that the Packers won anything. A friend of mine, who shall remain nameless, who was a big Atlanta Falcons fan, told me that you should have retitled it "The Year We Didn't Suck," but I, you know. Anyway, there's wise guys everywhere. But the 72 Packers were a team that was so unique, and I didn't really know this during the 70s because I didn't really investigate it like I did for the book. But they had a situation that no other team in the history of the game has had to deal with that I know of. Mm-hmm. And that is the fact that they had a head coach who should not have been a head coach in the National Football League, a man by the name of Dan Devine. He was over his head with pro coaching. And he would not only make a lot of mistakes strategically wise, but he bordered on arrogance, and he was also he wasn't above making fun of his own players in front of his other players, which really, you know, cultivated an us versus him type of a philosophy. They weren't expected to do anything. They had four wins the year before, and 20 of the players on that 72 team were brand new to the team. So they didn't have a whole lot of experience, but they somehow won 10 games in a 14-game season and won their division title, and they beat some playoff teams to get there. So, you know, they beat the defending world champion Cowboys to get there. And it was an unusual season for a team that just clicked right off the bat and somehow had to deal with a head coach that really should not have been their head coach or anyone's, at least not in the pro level. I mean, in a college level, he had done pretty successful. Dan Devine was successful at the University of Missouri. But after he coached the Packers for several years, he went to coaching Notre Dame. And he did, you know, he did okay. But, I mean, his player evaluation wasn't really great. I mean, he benched Joe Montana of all, you know. How much could he have known? So, I mean, they're the players that I interviewed for that book, a lot of them couldn't stand him. And a lot of them would say, hey, you know, when he's drawing up plays on the chalkboard, he's getting 10 players on the field and 12 players, but never 11. Hmm. And it's, you scratch your head and you wonder, why is this guy coach? You know, and so it's really an incredible book that takes you from the end of the 71 season all throughout the playoff game in 72 when they lost to the Redskins. And it was basically the head coach's fault. They had Bart Starr as a play caller. And on the eve of the playoff game, Coach Devine says, you're not calling the plays anymore. I will be tomorrow. And the rest is history. He basically had a run first op. You know, he just wanted to run the ball right up the gut. The Redskins noticed this and put an extra defensive lineman in, and that shut off the run. But even into the fourth quarter, he was just running dive runs. John Brockington was telling me he had 13 carries in that game for 9 yards.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, it was the most embarrassing day John Brockington said he ever had on a football field. And I believe him. And so it was a winnable game. They lost 16-3. And Dave Robinson told Scott Hunter, the quarterback, if you score 20 points, you'll win this game because the Redskins aren't going to score 20. And they didn't. But, you know, the Packers couldn't score more than a field goal thanks to their head coach.
Huh. Yeah, that's crazy that they got that far on the back of Bart Starr calling the plays, and then he decides, I'm going to go old school, I'm going to run the ball up the middle, and you know what's coming. And that, I guess the reason why I asked about this was I was just trying to figure out one season, like the Green Bay Packers 72, what made you decide, I want to write a whole book about this season?
Well, I started watching football in 71, but 72 was the first year that I really remember. And so I was paying attention to football in 71, but I was bit by the football bug by 72. And I had known that they had won a playoff game. I mean, that they had gone to the playoffs, they had won a division title, and that they had lost a playoff game. But then I didn't hear from them for the rest of the decade. And they went downhill really rapidly. And I thought, you know, if I could pick a team that I could write about that had an interesting story to it. And I looked around and I thought, well, everybody's written about the Steelers and everybody's written about the Cowboys. And I'm thinking, you know, the publisher is liable to give you an opportunity to write about a team that nobody else has written about before, especially if you've got something unique. And I didn't have to come up with unique. That was the team.
Right.
You know, but I knew that nobody had ever written about them before. So I fished the idea to the publishers, and they thought about it, and they said, well, your book on the 70s did pretty well, so we'll give you this opportunity. So it came out late last year, and it's been doing pretty well. You're cutting your audience short when you say it's only about the Packers, because I don't think there are too many Jacksonville fans that are going to buy it. but it's still it's interesting because of every one of us has had a bad boss in our lives, I think, especially if you get older and you start working different jobs and things. And I thought that, you know, this Dan Devine personage, you can really see the similarities between bad bosses and him. And you can see how this particular group of men addressed that situation on a day in and day out, experience. And that's why I think the book was unique. And so I pitched that idea and they said, okay, go with it. And so I was able to get in touch with some of the players, and they were interested in hearing somebody listen to their story.
So, right. Yeah.
My main goal, I'm going to try to get ESPN to do a 30 for 30 on it if they can. I think it'd be interesting. Now, of course, you can't interview Dan Devine anymore. It's kind of hard. He's been dead for several years, but
it'll make it difficult. Yeah,
very difficult. Yeah,
maybe my DeLorean.
Yeah, but you know, I think that it's a story worth telling, even if it doesn't make it to the screen. At least, you know, buy the book and you'll see some stuff and read some stuff that you'll be wondering, how could this team have ever won a division title? They did.
Right. Yeah. I mean, on the total flip side, that's why I was curious, because of that year, nobody ever thinks of that year without in the same breath saying the Miami Dolphins.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's cool because it's totally different conference and it's post Lombardi. It's all these kinds of things that it struck my core. Like, why? That's really just why would this be? But it sounds like it's more than a football book. It's a culture of the team. And because the guy at top created this travesty, but how the heck did you guys still win? So it's a whole human piece there. And then another one that you wrote, which I believe came out, was it this year?
Yeah.
The one with Willie Lanier?
Yeah. Early.
What was the perspective for that one?
Well, that's another unique story.
Another unique story, you say? Well, I'll tell you what. You're going to have to come back next week to check out Joe's journey in writing the book about Willie Lanier. He'll also share what his upcoming book's going to be, along with the story that most people would just go ahead and just, hey, have my right arm. I don't need this one anymore because I've lived my life. And you're going to be able to see what it was like in his shoes. And to give you a little bit of a teaser, that's around the late Hall of Famer Bart Starr. But speaking of living a dream, I have a favorite football moment for you from John Gay over at JAG in Detroit. Now, this is a dude that I met at Podcast Movement, and he sent over his favorite football moment, so you can go ahead and relive that with him. Take it away, John.
Hi, my name is John Gay. I own JAG in Detroit Podcast, a full-service podcast creation, production, and editing outfit. I did grow up in Boston, and I've been a lifelong Patriots fan. So for those of you who are under the age of 20 or so, the Patriots used to be really, really bad. I'd look forward to the away games because the home games would be blacked out from local TV and my dad and I would have to listen on the radio. So at least when they were on the road, we could see them. The 1-15 seasons, the 2-14 seasons, things were pretty bad for a while. But I got to thinking today with the announcement that Tom Brady is leaving, how grateful I am for the last 20 years of Tom Brady. And yeah, a lot of people hate him for a number of reasons, but the level of success of this dynasty has been unprecedented in history. In particular, I go back to probably my favorite moment ever, which was Super Bowl 36 against the Rams. I was a senior in college at Syracuse University, and I'd had some buddies over my apartment to watch the previous playoff games, the Raiders Snow Bowl game, the AFC Championship game the following week at Pittsburgh. And then, of course, the Super Bowl, we had probably 50 people in this house, 49 rooting for the Patriots and one rooting for the Rams. That little freshman almost got thrown out the window, but that's another story. So here we are, us against the world. Nobody gives us a chance. 14-point underdogs. And lo and behold, Ty Law has the pick six, and we are up 7-3. Brady hits Patton in the corner of the end zone to go up 14-3 at the half. Vinatieri hits a field goal to make it 17-3, and we are beside ourselves. We can't believe it. Rams are driving in the second half, getting ready to get closer. And there's a fumble. Tabucky Jones picks it up, runs it back 97 yards for a touchdown for a 24-3 lead. Or so we thought. Called back for a holding penalty on Willie McGinnis. And we're all screaming at the TV. I think I called him Willie Buckner, because at the time, this may sound strange, but Boston teams were used to losing. The only titles of my lifetime were the mid-80s Celtics, and I was too young to remember that. So we always found a way to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. So sure enough, the Rams score. They score again in lightning speed, greatest show on turf, and tie the game at 17, and we're just shell-shocked, like, there it goes again. We were never supposed to win anyway. We're going to lose. Brady gets the ball a minute and a half left. Madden says they should take a knee, and he starts hitting passes. Kevin Falk, Troy Brown, Jermaine Wiggins, who went on to be a radio host in Boston after that, and they're close enough for the field goal. And Vinatieri lines up and hits it. And I'm expecting there's going to be a kickoff, and somehow the last second ticks off the clock. And as the late, great Gil Santos exclaimed, you've probably heard the call, And the Patriots are Super Bowl champions. The Patriots are Super Bowl champions. The best team in the National Football League. And there's cheering and high fives. You can hear him behind him as he makes the call. We are doing keg stands. We are beside ourselves. We end up going to the senior bar, Fagan's, on the Syracuse University campus. Turns out the DJ's from New Hampshire. He plays We Are the Champions. He plays Dream On from Boston's own Aerosmith. And we did it. For the first time in our two decades on the planet, and for the first time in the 42-year history of the Patriots, we'd won. We were no longer the laughing stock. We'd won with this kid from Michigan, Tom Brady. Over the next 20 years, my radio career took me all over the country. It took me from Vermont to Detroit to New Orleans and back to Detroit. And yet, the Patriots and Tom Brady are what kept me close and what always made me feel like I was close to home. I have college friends that I've stayed in contact with through a group text thread about the Patriots. I have family members that we connect over talking about the Patriots and the marvelous, incredible, logic-defying things Tom Brady and the team have done to stay relevant for the first three Super Bowls, the next three Super Bowls, 10 years later, which 20 years ago I could have never imagined myself saying. And as I looked on social media this morning, I saw so many people that were angry, upset, frustrated. You know, this was just one more thing on top of what's certainly been a challenging week in the world. And this just seemed like one more thing on top of it. And don't for a second think I'm comparing sports to the coronavirus and the horrible things happening with that. But my overriding thought as I watch my favorite athlete ever leave the team that I love and that I've loved since I was a very little kid, I'm just grateful. I'm grateful for 20 years of always being relevant and always being in the conversation, and almost always at least being in the AFC Championship game, if not the Super Bowl. And the Giants' Super Bowl losses were brutal. The Eagles' Super Bowl loss was brutal. But we were always there. And there's no other team in football that can say that. And I'm not trying to sound like an arrogant Patriots fan, but what Tom Brady meant to New England, and it was a way for me to stay connected to friends and family as I moved all over the country, and some of them did too, I'm just grateful to have been able to watch a player with that talent and that drive and that motivation succeed for my team for the last 20 years. And no matter what happens from here on out, that 20 years was just an unbelievable run. And I'm so thankful to Tom Brady and Bill Belichick and Bob Kraft for the joyous moments that I've been able to share with those I love for so long. So that's my story, Super Bowl 36 and Tom Brady. Once again, my name is John Gay. I'm from JAG in Detroit Podcast. I create podcasts for small businesses and nonprofits. My website, jagindetroit.com. You can also find me on social media at JAG in Detroit. That's JAGINDETROIT. Arnie, it was great meeting you at Podcast Movement last summer. Hope we can connect again soon. Thanks.
Now, how about that favorite moment? Now, I'm torn on Brady myself. I mean, the dude, on one respect, you got to figure, hey, he's done something that nobody else has ever done. But at the same time, if you're not a Patriots fan, you're like, let's quit talking about the Patriots. Of course, he's not with the Bucks, but hey, I'm still thinking. I'm getting annoyed talking about this dude all the time. But for my sake, let's just hope that some of that hooded one magic rubbed off on Patricia, because I feel like what John talked about with the Patriots a while ago, just being the laughingstock for so long. I want to get to the point where we are not the laughingstock. I want to be the ones like the Patriots creating that dynasty that is unheard of in modern times. But we'll have to talk about that on a different show, because that's not happening right now. In fact, maybe you could call that, if they ever won it, my favorite football moment of all time. And I didn't share one of these in a while because I haven't really had a whole lot of them come in. But I do love hearing them. So if you want to send your favorite football moment, if we can play it on the podcast, send it on in. The best way to do that is you can go to myfootballmoment.com, and that'll take you right to the website. Again, that's myfootballmoment.com. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.